Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. We are live from the ITU AI for Good conference in Geneva, Switzerland. I am thrilled to have with us a distinguished guest, Professor Dr. David Sinclair. Dr. David Sinclair is at the Harvard Medical School, but more importantly, he's been a leading voice in terms of longevity. He's written 500 papers, done over 50 patents. He runs a very successful podcast called Lifespan, and he's also written a New York Times bestseller on this topic. We're going to have a lot of discussions on AI and longevity, but before that, I would like Professor Dr. Sinclair to tell our listeners who are global around the world a little bit about yourself and how you got to this point.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. As you said, a professor at Harvard Medical School. Mm-hmm. I run a lab there. I've been there for the last 25 years. And before that, I trained at MIT. And my expertise is in the biology of aging. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing this long enough since when aging was not fashionable. But of course, it's taken off in popularity. Mm-hmm. What else about myself? I have the equivalent of an Australian knighthood. I'm an entrepreneur. I've started successful companies. Four of them have gone public. Mm-hmm. And I use the proceeds from those activities to fund more research and fund more companies and keep making the world hopefully a better place. Mm-hmm. And my goal, my mission, is with my partner Serena to improve the lives of billions of people by understanding aging and slowing and even reversing that process.
Fantastic. Understanding aging and slowing, I'm sure a lot of our listeners want that. Professor, how are you using AI in terms of longevity and the work you're doing, and how has your work changed with generative AI coming? AI has been there for a long period of time, but tell our listeners, how have things changed in the, let's say, in the past 3 years, for example?
Yeah. Well, we use AI a lot in my lab for many different things. Design of experiments, mm-hmm. just testing ideas, but also being able to speed up drug development and the finding of new molecules that can reverse aging. Mm-hmm. A couple of examples. One is that we use AI to see whether we can reverse the age of cells. Mm-hmm. And if you and I look at cells under the microscope, we cannot tell the difference between a young and an old cell. Mm-hmm. But when you train an AI model, they can do it within a nanosecond. The other thing that we do is we do drug discovery in my lab. Usually, this would be done by a pharmaceutical company and cost millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. I asked ChatGPT how long it would take for my lab to do this by mm-hmm. ourselves. It's estimated over 150 years, costing $27 billion in reagents. Wow. Instead, it's costing us $30,000, and we can do this in just 6 months. And it's so this is what AI is now able, makes us able to be like a pharmaceutical company and find molecules that have properties that have the age reversal that before we could only dream about.
So, we have a lot of policymakers, members of Congress, Senate, and other leaders come on the show. And every one of them says, Professor, that the most benefit of AI is going to be in medical research, drug discovery, etc. And you are kind of saying that you're already doing that. In terms of policy and in terms of data privacy, what are the implications of, we've had a recent situation with 23andMe where there's a lot of people's genetic data. And so what concern should lawmakers or people have in terms of the use of such data?
As a customer of 23andMe, I understand mm-hmm. the situation. And we do a lot of genomic data as well on,
yes,
not just on animals, but on people. And I think it's very, very important to allow people to own their own data. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I'm working on a number of projects, partly through the Lifespan mm-hmm. group, which is my podcast, but also I'm building a large wellness community, mm-hmm. a longevity community that we're launching soon. Mm-hmm. And so we're right in the middle of trying to understand how can we have our customers, our clients, own their own data mm-hmm. in perpetuity. And so that if you give your medical data, you own it. Mm-hmm. You can share it if you want. But in the event that the company is bought, or, you know, even worse, we go bankrupt, not that I imagine that's going to happen, but in the case of 23andMe, that's what happened. And so we're looking at having it as a written statement that every customer in perpetuity owns their data and it cannot be sold. And I totally agree that you should. And if you do choose to give your data, you should share in the profits from giving that data.
So you should share in profits, because that's something that has come up, and you should own it in perpetuity. I'm sure our listeners as well as policymakers are thrilled to hear that. Professor, you talked about having that there would be somebody living for maybe 150 years or is already living. Is the perspective on people living longer, people living well, or a combination of both?
Well, first and foremost, it's living well. I've never been able to extend the lifespan of any organism without keeping them healthy. That's what causes the longevity as a side effect. And if we cannot keep an animal, or in a human study, we cannot keep those people healthy, we don't work on it. It has to start with the brain, because if you don't keep the brain healthy, we don't think it's worth it. But fortunately, every molecule that we've worked on has not just kept the body young and healthy, but also the brain.
So keep the body and the brain together. Professor, longevity is a global issue. It impacts everybody around the world. So there are two questions that I have is, you're using AI. If AI helps you with the longevity, we have different rules and regulations, EU AI Act. In the US, we don't have a federal law. I'm based in Washington, so I can tell you we're not going to have a federal law. But different states have rules and regulations, and around the world, for your work, but also for others who are doing drug discovery, etc., does it help to have some kind of conformity or standard rules and regulations to work with?
Well, in drug discovery, right now, there's a race to be the best software, to find the best molecules, to find the safest molecules. I don't think that bringing regulation into that area would be a good thing yet.
Okay.
I might be wrong because I'm a biologist, but I don't see that being a threat. I think that's an AI for good, a good example of what AI should be used for.
Right.
And that regulation may actually slow that down. But ultimately, if we get AGI or something like it, then yes, we have to be careful that they don't go rogue and do something that we don't expect. But right now, we're far from that. Our software that we develop and others are developing are not smart enough to be a threat. And if that starts to happen, yes, but not yet. And I don't want it to slow down, because we could shave years and tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, off the cost of drugs eventually, of developing drugs.
So what you're saying is, let's focus on innovation, which could yield such incredible benefits to us, and let us not slow down. The other question, it comes to globalization of longevity, etc. The question, Professor, is when we look at a digital divide globally, there could be a potential AI divide. Will your work, and I'm not picking on you per se, but other drug discovery also benefit the global south, or is there going to be some kind of a disparity that happens?
It's a very good question. And in my book, Lifespan, if anyone's read it, they know. The last one third of the book is about this issue, about what happens when, and it's not an if, it's a when, there are drugs that slow and even reset the body's age. Right now, the drugs that are being developed are expensive. I will admit, the drugs that we have in development could cost tens of thousands and possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, if you're going to cure blindness, which is one of the things we're aiming for, that's worth it for the country, for the insurance company. But that's not long term. It cannot be available to everybody at that price. So my lab is working on bringing the cost down very quickly. So we're working on making it into a pill rather than a gene therapy, which could be thousands of dollars and eventually hundreds of dollars to treat blindness and other conditions. But like most technologies, it does start out more expensive than we want. And richer nations support the development. But ultimately, as with all technologies, it will be the same for longevity, that the prices hopefully very rapidly will come down so that everybody and every country can afford those.
So ultimately, the price is going to definitely come down. Professor, when we look at, you know, in terms of rules and regulations that have been set up, you have worked as an entrepreneur across drug discovery as well as patient care. I mean, you've had many successful, I mean, and that's the uniqueness about you. Should the regulations which ever come in the future distinguish between drug discovery and patient care, et cetera?
Yes, they should. So drug discovery is a separate question about mm-hmm. how quickly can we try new therapies without endangering mm-hmm. individuals. Mm-hmm. And right now, there are many regulations around the world that that slow down that process for some good reasons. Mm-hmm. But in some countries, particularly the U.S., there's a lot of barriers to going quickly. Mm-hmm. And so right now, Washington, particularly this administration, is looking at bringing down those barriers mm-hmm. and allowing drug development to be quicker and cheaper, which ultimately will translate to cheaper and quicker drugs, which mm-hmm. I think everybody would agree would be a good thing mm-hmm. as long as it's safe. And that's where AI comes in. Mm-hmm. AI will help us find safer molecules quicker mm-hmm. without the use of lots of studies in animals and even lots of studies in people. We can find those. Even my little lab at Harvard with 30 people, we're using AI to find safe molecules even before we give it to a mouse, which is great. Now, you asked about wellness. Now, that's different. Wellness is taking your own health into your own hands mm-hmm. and working with your doctor, but on a daily basis with monitoring, with rings and other apps and AI. Mm-hmm. It can be your guardian angel for health that's with you all the time with monitors, looking at your blood glucose and these other things. And that's actually what I'm working on now is a wellness community and a wellness platform so that you can be looked after every second of your day, every second of your life. And then you bring in your doctor and experts when needed. And in terms of regulation of that, we do need regulations, and especially when it comes to privacy of data, as you mentioned.
Right. So pretty exciting times. Professor, is it, you know, I have a lot of friends in pharma and they say it takes 10 years and $1 billion to come up with a drug, et cetera. Is it in the tech world now, they're saying you could have a one-person unicorn. Do you think a 30% company can be producing blockbuster drugs based because of AI?
I do.
And I'm just using 30 as a number. Yeah, it's a coincidence, but 20%, 30%, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, one of my companies, Life Biosciences in Boston, we used to have over 100 people. And we have labs, and it was very expensive. Mm-hmm. Then the pandemic hit, and AI came, mm-hmm. and we're now down to 15 people, and we're even more productive with fewer people because of AI and outsourcing globally. And that's, for me, the best model for the biotech industry, maybe for pharma, that you don't need as many people within the company, mm-hmm. Or in total, if you can use AI to skip some steps and improve mm-hmm. the efficiency.
The clinical trial process is generally, I mean, it's done for safety, yeah. but it is a long, cumbersome, complicated, expensive process. Do you think AI and tools like digital twins can help in that process?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It already is. It already is speeding. Alex Zakharonkov, who spoke with me at this conference mm-hmm. on the same stage, he talked about In Silico Medicine, his company, his CEO, yes. and he's shown, as well as we have shown, that AI can greatly speed up the preclinical stage. Mm-hmm. And now the roadblock, or at least the slow step, mm-hmm. is the regulated part in mm-hmm. humans. So if we can speed up preclinical and then also with AI speed up the clinical human development, we could have drugs in half the time that they are now wow. and at half the cost, even less.
That's fantastic. Professor, we have a lot of policymakers who listen to our show, who come on our show and listen to our show. What would your advice be to some of them? Now, remember, they don't have a scientific background. They're very smart people, but they don't have a scientific background like you do. As they are formulating policies, they want to see the benefit, but they want to make sure the public is safe, etc. What would your recommendations be to them? Just sit back, don't do anything, or what should they, what would your message be to them?
Well, in the US, it's a good example. Policymakers, politicians are looking very closely, line by line, at the regulations and deleting those that are unnecessary. And I think that's what's going to happen, because over the last 70 years, it's been regulation upon regulation upon regulation that's led to these very expensive medicines. And being able to reduce that burden on biotech companies without sacrificing safety will be the key for global prosperity and global health. And we can have five times as many medicines and all of them much cheaper if we can just reduce that final stage of clinical development. And instead of it taking 7 years to get a drug and 9 out of 10 fail because it's just so expensive and we run out of money, we can have maybe 1 in 3 or even almost every drug that goes into humans can work thanks to AI pre-screening only those molecules that are safe and effective even before we test it in people.
So lots of opportunities, obviously want to do it with safety and other things.
Yeah.
There's a community of biohacking that does a lot of work on longevity. But from what you're saying is, this is, it's going to be one single medicine that'll help from that perspective. Professor, is that, what is the timeline? Is it going to be something that someone like me could take in my lifetime, or that'll be my son taking that?
Well, it depends on how healthy you are. But no,
not after all these podcasts a day.
Yeah, that's true. That's tough. But there are things you can do every day, of course.
Sure.
Eating well and exercising are obvious ones. Having a reliable partner or social network. But even there are supplements and medicines. If you listen to my podcast, Lifespan, you'll know that there are things we can do every day to live longer, without a doubt. But also in terms of the timeline of drug development, I'm part of studies that are, I think, 7 clinical trials right now, some of which are already shown benefit. These are in phase 2, so we have to go through phase 3, but that's only a couple of years away. That's for some of the early molecules that slow aging. We have age reversal technology now, gene therapy, and that's been in monkeys now and works for curing blindness. And we're going into people next year in January. And I hope that if we can fast track that with the government's help, that we could have a medicine for people that could start with curing blindness, but then curing other diseases and eventually whole body age reset within our lifetimes. And really the biggest thing that any regulator could do for the health of the planet is to make aging a medical condition that we can treat. Right now, we cannot develop a drug to treat aging because it's not considered a medical condition. But like obesity used to be just bad luck or bad eating. It became, 10 years ago, a medical condition.
Ozempic.
And now we have Ozempic, and it's a huge industry.
Wegovy and...
So do that for aging.
Some of it might even help with aging, too.
Exactly. I mean... Exactly. But the regulators can change the world by making aging a medical condition. And then we'll get funding. We'll get medical research that focuses on treating the root cause of disease, not just the symptoms.
So we have a lot of policymakers who listen to us. As I said, they come on our show all the time. If they make it an acknowledged disease, so to speak, or condition, how would that change things for not just you, but for the whole scientific community?
Well, first of all, there'd be research dollars pouring in from philanthropy, and presumably from the National Institutes of Health, because it's now seen as a legitimate drug target.
Yes.
But also investment from entrepreneurs and pharmaceutical companies. There would be a legitimate reason to focus on aging rather than using surrogate ways to get a drug on the market. So the reason that I'm going after blindness, even though it's important, is because I cannot directly target aging, because there's no way to get reimbursement from the insurance companies for aging. So we have to use these other smaller diseases instead of going after the mother of them all, aging itself, which really causes most diseases on the planet. The same cause of diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's is actually aging, And we now understand in a large part what causes that problem. And we can tackle it with medicines.
So for our audience members, especially policymakers, we need to get this, as classified as a condition, which would help, focus a lot of research materials and have talented people like Professor Sinclair doing work on this. And we really hope that something like that happens. Professor, it's so good to have you, and I really wish all the best for you. And thanks so much for giving such great insight to our listeners.
Oh, you're welcome. And a final shameless plug.
Please.
Because all of the research dollars from the U.S. government was cut to zero in my lab, and I want to save my students and my scientists from losing their salaries over the next few months, I've set up a friendsofsinclairlab.org account where you can help us, support us, and keep the research going.
Friendsofsinclairlab.org. Please go there to support the work, the incredible work that Professor is doing. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Great questions. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.